Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up for Monday, February 20th, 2026. I'm your host, Magnus Thiebald. I think Peter R.H. will be joining me later in the program for his segment. We have a bunch of good stuff lined up for you today. Joining me in the studio today is Dr. David Freeman, SFU professor in the Department of Economics, and we're going to be talking in a moment about the BC budget and what that means and what are some of the challenges the province is facing that budget shows us. After that, we have a really interesting news segment from Madia Khan called Health Matters. And she's a, she used to do a show here called Health Matters many years ago, and she's recently completed her training at medical school. And she's going to be doing a little regular series for us looking into healthcare and navigating the healthcare system and things that are interesting like that. And Peter will be here later for his segment. Bird notes, some good music, and a bunch of other stuff. So sit back and enjoy. Welcome.
Thanks, Magnus, for having me.
Dr. David Freeman, SFU professor in the Department of Economics. last week, the BC government brought down its annual budget. And before the budget... came out, the finance minister, Brenda Bailey, was preparing everybody for not amazing news on it. She was saying that she was going to be very unpopular once it came out. And once it did come out last week, it did seem pretty much everyone had something they could be unhappy about it, whether it was the business community, the labor, workers, social service folks, everybody had something to be upset about. What challenges? I mean, obviously, governments, when they put together a budget, they're hoping to come out of it with a little boost, and you know, throw in some good news to make people happy. That didn't seem to be an option for them this time. What were the challenges that made it so?
I mean, like, let's just look at our economic performance kind of over the last 10 years in Canada. It's been, you know, after adjusting for inflation and population growth, the Canadian economy basically hasn't grown in 10 years. Mm-hmm. If you look in BC, I saw reports from 2023 and 2024 that actually, if you know, adjusting for inflation and population growth, we actually had negative GDP growth. Our overall, the size of our economy, adjusting for those things, is actually stagnating, maybe even getting lower. And then, of course, when Eby took power, I mean, this is the big story. He started spending a lot more. Mm-hmm. Spending went way up, and it's kind of caught up with them. They've, you know, looking. I think their economic forecasts are a little bit optimistic. They've consistently blown their projections. It looks to me like they thought they could handle the spending, but the economy just has been really stagnating and hasn't kept up. And so now we're stuck with these persistent structural deficits that are leading to more debt that will, down the road, require either some very hard choices, either much higher taxes or possibly a massive reduction in the scope of government. I mean, these are...
Right. So the pandemic sort of represents, for many things, a sort of turning point on many issues. And certainly on the economic front, it represented a huge disruption to everything happening within economies. Was part of what was going on here for BC and maybe elsewhere as well an expectation that the recovery from that, the bounce back from that, would be bigger?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really see that in the sense that, I mean, possibly, but if we look at the economic growth in Canada over a 10-year horizon, including, you know, before the pandemic, it was pretty slow, almost zero. It was lower, you know, in the 10 years before that, it was, you know, about, in Canada, about 1% on, you know, adjusting for inflation and population growth. you know, whereas it was, you know, 1.8% the 10 years before that. So yeah, I mean, the economy in Canada does seem to be, the growth does seem to be slowing. That does seem to be somewhat structural, and this is across Canada. So in terms of the bounce back, yeah, I mean, yeah, we had a bit of a bounce back, but growth has been relatively slow. And yeah, and in terms of the size of the deficits, I mean, I think you just have to look at, start looking at the numbers. If you kind of take out the COVID blip, you know, spending and revenues kind of have been, mostly kind of consistently growing with the economy. And right. then until EB took over, and then spending went way up.
Right.
So that's really what happened. I mean, I think that's the story of the budget.
Yeah, and the deficit has been one of the big points that has gotten a lot of chatter since the budget came out. But depending on how you measure it, the current budget isn't necessarily, or not, sorry, budget, but deficit is not really out of line with historical norms.
No, so let's separate between debt and deficits, right?
Yeah.
So a deficit is the gap between revenue and expenditure. So yeah. If you spend more money than you're bringing in revenue, you have to borrow that money. So if you're doing that personally, you'd maybe borrow on a credit card. Or if you're doing that because you're buying a house, you know, you take out a mortgage, right? And so that's what a deficit is. The debt is the accumulated borrowing,
yeah.
right? And so the deficit is way out of line with historical norms.
Okay.
During COVID, which was this massive economic downturn and a pandemic, the deficit was $6 billion.
Yeah.
The EB government is forecasting a $13 billion deficit in the coming fiscal year. This is just more than double what was happening under COVID.
Mm-hmm.
So the rate of borrowing is the real story.
Yeah.
The fact that our debt situation is actually not that bad compared to, say, other provinces, yeah. or at least, and it certainly wasn't, when EB took over in 2022. You know, it was actually, I think we had the second lowest debt to GDP ratio.
Yeah.
So with the size of our debt relative to the size of our economy, it was actually the second best in Canada when EB took over.
Yeah.
But it's going to be forecast to be among the worst if he finishes his term.
Yeah.
So that's the story, is that the deficit is out of control, and the debt problem is going to keep getting worse. Take BC from being one of Canada's best managed provinces under Horgan and the BC Liberals before them, yeah. to our fiscally potentially worst managed provinces, and create massive structural problems going down the road.
How is BC's performance compared to other provinces?
So performance in,
I guess, in terms of, I'm thinking in the moment about, government fiscal performance, relative to, the deficit, taxation levels versus borrowing levels,
Yeah, so if we compare us to, say, Ontario, which, the biggest province, so probably a good comparator, our GDP per person is pretty similar.
Yeah.
Ontario's debt to GDP ratio is higher, but it was also higher when Doug Ford took power years ago, and their debt to GDP ratio has been roughly stable. I think Ontario probably got hit quite a bit more by the Trump tariffs. Ontario has a big auto manufacturing industry, a big steel industry.
Mm-hmm.
BC doesn't, we have a smelter, an aluminum smelter in Kitimat. I think we're hit a lot less hard by the Trump tariffs.
Yeah.
And so, they're roughly stable in terms of their debt to GDP ratio. Like, the fiscal management is okay.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas BC's, our fiscal problem, our fiscal balance is going to keep getting worse. And that's going to, going forward, threaten our ability of the ability of our government to provide basic services unless we, either raise taxes or kind of cut the scope of government drastically.
Right. So the government is proposing, I think, in their fiscal plan next year, it'd be $12 billion, which is still higher than last year's deficit, down to $11 billion. Do you feel that's fast enough progress on those numbers?
No, absolutely not. And so, and for context, I think they forecast that this year, when they first took power in their, in their 2023 budget, they forecast that the deficit, I think, in 24, 25, or 25, 26, they forecast it would be $3 billion. Well, it's actually, the 24, 25 deficit was actually closer to $10
billion. Right.
So they're consistently blowing their forecasts. When I look at the economic forecast, both on inflation and on growth, I think they're, especially given that there's a little bit of an immigration backlash, there seems to be kind of just persistently slow growth in Canada for the last decade. you know, I think their forecasts are a little optimistic. And then they have this history of, you know, like finding, oh, well, there's, we want to help, we want to solve this problem. So I think that things could be much, much worse than what they forecast.
Right.
And keep in mind that we have this kind of government capacity problem where why did they start spending money? Well, you know, you had ER closures and you had people without family doctors and we had this health capacity problem. And they tried to solve that problem by spending money, but they haven't solved the problem.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is still very much there.
Yeah.
And so there will be a huge pressure on them from within their caucus to spend more money. So this problem...
And that's definitely a problem that needs to be solved.
So, yeah, you know, I mean, absolutely. I think people should have access to family doctors. So where in terms... Now, you asked, how is BC doing compared to other provinces?
Yeah.
Look at the tax structure.
Yeah.
If you look at the income tax burden on someone in BC, you know, kind of play with it, you know, using a tax calculator, compare it to other provinces like Ontario, our income taxes are, you know, are a little bit lower than, say, Ontario's.
Mm-hmm.
So on paper, if you want to be an NDP tax and spend government, you could probably raise income taxes, although really, if you're borrowing money, implicitly, there's a tax on the future that either they're going to pay more taxes or get less government services.
Yeah.
So they are effectively raising taxes. They're just, it's not kicking the can down the road.
Yeah.
So, you know, the capacity is there, but where I would worry is that, you know, GDP growth has been very slow. You know, the tax increases they have, they will, like, say, adding, say, PST to, like, engineering services, it'll disincentivize people from hiring engineers. How significant is that going to be? I'm not sure. But, you know, I don't know if that's going to be that big of an effect, but if, right, you know, you increase taxes, I think that, you know, if they decide to have a massive tax increase only on the highest earners, well, I mean, that could end up backfiring. At least it would to some extent. So,
right. So one of the things I hear a lot from economically sort of oriented commentators on the right is that Canada lags in growth, and that a big part of that is, well, government has a big role in either fostering productivity or hindering it in some fashion. And the criticism I hear, and I'm not going to get into specifics, is a little outside of my solid understanding, but that's what I'm going to ask you about.
Sure. Yeah.
is that Canada could be doing a lot more to promote productivity and that would help with growth, and that we, for instance, lag behind the United States in that. And a really unusual statistic, not necessarily about Canada, I heard recently, was that the U.S. compared to Europe, the European Union, in terms of growth, I just saw someone commentating, so I don't even remember the source, but was that, for instance, the U.S. economy had grown by, like, over a set period of time, the last 20 years, let's say, like 50%, 40%, and the European economy had grown only something like 25%. There's this huge gap. And so we get this comparison often that we're falling behind the U.S. in particular, or maybe the U.S. is an outlier. But what do our government here in B.C. or governments generally here in Canada need to be doing to address that issue?
Yeah, so I think that's a really good question. And I think you ask economists first, I think economists and not just economists on the right would say that Canada does have a productivity gap with the U.S. We just, per hour worked, we just produce less stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah, I think that economists both on the left and right can agree that that's a problem.
Yeah.
And we might disagree on, say, on why it's a problem, what to do about it, and how much of that money should be going to, say, healthcare versus should be left to private citizens.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think this is a broad problem of fiscal capacity. So what can governments do about it? So, when you mentioned, by the way, the US and EU comparisons, you know, from 2015 to 2024, Canada had the lowest growth after adjusting for inflation and GDP in the OECD, except for Luxembourg.
Right.
The OECD is a big group of advanced economies. So that's, you know, we are actually doing really quite badly. So first, let's acknowledge the scope of the problem.
Yeah.
Second, you know, I think, you know, if you go ask people in the business community, like, where are their disincentives to grow your business, to invest? You know, some of the stats that I saw that were most concerning were that business investment in worker training tend to be lower in Canada than in the U.S. and in other OECD countries.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, that's one reason that there's a gap. that low business investment. And then second, let's think about the businesses that don't exist. What, you know, where are there potential entrepreneurs who might start a business and scale it in Canada?
Yeah.
And so how can we foster that pipeline? And I know there's multiple parts to that, but it even, you know, we put a lot of money into our university sector, mm-hmm. but how many, you know, we're getting far fewer patents coming out of it and new business startups relative to, say, the United States, even though we have this big publicly funded, relatively well-funded university yeah. sector. So I think that kind of turbocharging that innovation engine, those early stage startups, maybe there's a small role for government there, since for the government's role in education and improving the educational sector more broadly.
Yeah.
I think that would be one area I'd look to for growth. You know, looking for those easy wins in terms of cleaning up corporate the way that corporate taxes are structured, there might be some easy wins there. Honestly, I think bureaucratic red tape is probably where the biggest gains come from. Asking, you know, whenever there's a business regulation, do we mm-hmm. need it? Would we be happy just getting rid of the regulation and letting and giving businesses more room to kind of run their own affairs? I mean, yeah. look, the government absolutely needs to regulate businesses, but every time it regulates a business, there's a cost.
Yeah.
And I think one of the kind of, I think you need to think in terms of, and sort of the third or fourth point I'd make, I think the Carney and the Trudeau and Carney governments have had a bit of a, some people call it self-corruption. It's kind of the wrong word.
Yeah.
But, you know, they have been big on government handouts to businesses, kind of the government, their attitude is the government should kind of, you know, manage the economy, give business handouts, corporate welfare, kind of try to guide growth.
Right. Like, you know, money for a battery plant or supporting
exactly.
Bombardier's.
Great examples. You know. And that is so easy for that process to get politicized. What does it reward? It rewards businesses that can navigate the political process.
Yeah.
When, like, if you look at where's the growth in the U.S. economy coming from, you ask a random person on the street, they would probably, and correctly, say, oh, yeah, AI is driving growth in the U.S. And that's driving a lot of growth. And
yeah.
going forward, going 10 years forward, I would expect that the AI is going, AI and how that enters into businesses, that's going to probably drive a lot of productivity gains mm-hmm. across the Western world. So, you know, when we look at, say, in BC, almost all of the job growth in the last couple of years since EB took over has been in the public sector, where there
right.
hasn't really been much productivity growth. You know, hard to measure productivity in the public sector, so
yeah.
that's, you know, maybe
yeah.
an unfair statement. But, you know, are there things we can do to turbocharge AI growth? You know,
mm-hmm.
not all the growth is going to come from just ChatGPT. Some of the growth will be coming from people who figure out how to adapt that to, say,
yep.
Say help governments or help the health sector, or, you know, so it can be applied in the health sector,
yep.
or maybe it can be used in, like, building houses. I mean, that's further down the road.
Yeah.
So there's, I think, plenty of growth room, but, and, you know, the government needs, if the government kind of gets out of the way, it makes it easy for people to start a business, encourages innovation, tries to build that culture of innovation here in Canada, starting from universities and maybe some, you know, funding at the early stages,
right.
And perhaps government, you know, I think maybe downsizing the public sector and, you know, implementing AI more mm-hmm. AI use in the public sector
yeah.
in healthcare, education, and so on. That would also provide a bit of a stimulus to it. So I think there are some opportunities, but we should be wary of government picking winners. And
yeah.
if they're going to do that, they need to be really smart. And I'm a little pessimistic on a record. And when you look back on the record, you know, since 2015 of, you know, this kind of crony capitalism,
yeah.
You know, I'm not,
right.
it hasn't really worked very well. So,
right. So back to the budget, where, you know, as I mentioned, the government has made some cuts. They've done some small tax increases. Nevertheless, the projection for the next few years is still large budgets, which are supposed to shrink a bit. But you already spoke of some concern about them hitting their targets. Where do you think they should be trying to go with it?
Where should they be trying to go with it? Well, so, I mean, So I think the question is, who am I going to give advice to? If I can be quite frank, I don't think the NDP is willing to recognize or they're not willing to admit to themselves or to the public just how big of a problem this is, the scale of this problem.
Yeah,
they raise taxes, but relative to the deficit, these tax increases are quite small. Mm-hmm. They're really, I mean, they put a little dent in it, not much. They say they're going to look at the public sector and maybe downsize the public sector a little bit, mostly through retirements. Well, that doesn't sound like they've really thought too much about what the public sector does, why it does it, and they might save some money. Will probably also end up cutting some people who are actually being productive, which will hurt our service delivery. So it doesn't seem like they've really thought that through, but. Big picture is that what they've done so far, it's pretty marginal. They're only starting to kind of recognize that there's a problem without recognizing the scope. So if they want to continue to spend the way they have, quite frankly, I think they owe it to taxpayers. I mean, look, British Columbians elect a government to govern on our behalf.
Yeah.
And they owe it to taxpayers to be honest with us and say, look, if we keep borrowing at this rate, we're either going to have crippling taxes in the future, or we're going to have to cut some major core government function, privatize healthcare, get rid of publicly funded universities, which would be just, if we keep doing this for another 10, 20 years.
Right.
I mean, would anyone vote for getting rid of public healthcare in 20 years if that's the cost of our trajectory now? I wouldn't, and I don't think most Canadians would. And most British Columbians would. But I think they need to really level and either get spending under control or raise taxes. I would like to see also, the opposition come up with some creative ideas for improving government capacity.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps, I would love to see, say, the BC Conservatives, maybe campaign on more AI use in government, more AI use in healthcare as a way to improve our productivity of government. Maybe not necessarily cut spending, but at least improve service delivery without really raising costs. Mm-hmm. I think that's a huge opportunity, both politically and to improve our government functioning. Yeah. But
all right. Thanks so much for coming in today, Dr. David Freeman, professor of economics here at SFU. Thanks for coming in today and giving us your thoughts around the budget and how we're doing in BC.
Thanks so much, Magnus. Frederick Chad.
Great. We'll have you back again. All right. Thanks to Dr. David Freeman for that. Right now we have coming up here is Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. In Mexico City, 73-year-old Katia Latouf started a hummingbird hospital in her apartment.
I have now here almost 6 species. I have a small one like a bee. It doesn't fly like a hummingbird. It's a Mexican.
The bumblebee hummingbird.
Yeah.
Either flying across a bedroom to a large window or resting over the dry tree branches Katia carefully placed on the corners, there are more hummingbirds than most people have ever seen together.
Now I have 82, expecting one more.
Katia says people bring her mostly injured baby birds. Larger animals attack them while they're vulnerable in their nests.
People find them, compassionate people, and they bring them to me.
So how did Katia, who once ran a French high fashion boutique, start caring for injured hummingbirds? It began in 2012, after she survived cancer that was considered terminal. She received her first injured hummingbird and named him Gucci.
Sometimes he was here and I was depressed. He stayed on my shoulder, on my head. No, Gucci, I don't want to play now. Please leave me alone. And he used to stay in front of me, looking at me, like saying, pay attention to me. I didn't understand at the time until he dies 9 months later. And it was a new life written to me, because 9 months is the symbol of a new life. When you have a baby, it's 9 months.
Katia has tried giving a new life to each one of the hundreds of babies she's received ever since. For Bird Note, I'm Lucina Melesio.
Noise of Carpet explores 1990s indie classics, recently exhumed underground gems. every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time and 9 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time. Tune in if you're a slacker, loser, or creep for an hour of positively nostalgic triggers and some new stuff, too, on CJSF 90.1 FM or streaming at cjsf.ca.
Many years ago, Medea Mahmood, an aspiring doctor, hosted a program here on CJSF called Health Matters, where she looked into many issues around health and working with the healthcare system and issues and concerns and things people should be thinking about and knowing about when dealing with the healthcare, with their own health and the healthcare system. Now, many years later, she's completed her studies and is a doctor, starting out her career as a trained physician. And she's going to be doing a series for us again. Now she is Medea Khan. And she's going to be doing a regular segment for us here at CJSF, also called Health Matters, where she's going to be talking to various professionals, healthcare professionals. And today she's looking into substance use with an emergency room physician. So here is Medea Khan's segment, Health Matters.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Health Matters. This is your host, Dr. Medea Khan. I'm here today with a very special guest speaker, Dr. Philip Yoon. He's here with us today to speak on the topic of substance use. So without further ado, let's get started. Hi, Dr. Yoon. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's lovely to have you here. Can you please start off by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Sure, Medea. Pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me. And I think this is a very important topic that you have selected for today. So I am a recently retired emergency physician. I practiced for approximately 30 years in the area of trauma, critical care, and emergency medicine with a special focus on pre-hospital medicine. So I am recently retired from the Royal Columbian Hospital and am currently kind of in my post-retirement days focused on pre-hospital care provided by first responders.
Okay, wonderful. Well, thank you. We're very honored to have you here today. And we're just going to get right into it then. So just to begin, Dr. Yoon, what are some of the most common, you would say, drug and alcohol-related emergencies that you've seen in the ER?
So, again, I'm very glad that you're covering this topic because, as you know, and many people know, and probably all too personally, the current opioid crisis has touched many people's lives and often in a tragic and permanent way. And in my time working in the emergency department, this was something was an all too common presentation around drug and alcohol overdoses. And these were cases that were all very much emergencies, and typically they would be involve patients with the toxic effects of a particular substance, whether it be a medication, a drug that they would get from the street, or the imbibing of excessive alcoholic beverages.
Right. Okay. Thank you for sharing that. That's very interesting. I would also like to just ask you a little bit about. We're here to, I would suppose, elaborate a little bit more about the differences for students on campus and the general public when it comes down to common conditions in which one is either too intoxicated versus experiencing life-threatening overdose, and how to perhaps tell the difference between those. If you can offer some key